Have you got some great songs but no one is listening? Are you struggling to find your audience? Worry no longer. Go to musiciansmap.org/free-book and download a copy of the free ebook, How to Get Your Music Heard. It talks about growing your fan base, finding your niche, and getting your music out there. The essential foundations you need and the steps to take to get your music heard. How to Get Your Music Heard. Get it now at musiciansmap.org/free-book. Long-time listeners will have noticed that there aren't any current sponsors for this podcast, and the front bumper is just a kind of tongue-in-cheek ad/jingle for the Musicians Map books. Well, we're entering the territory where getting some sponsors on board is starting to become viable, in that there's enough of you listening to warrant companies wanting to buy advertising space, much like they do on the more popular podcasts you no doubt listen to. Sponsors could mean a lot to a small podcast like this, which, up until now, is made entirely out of love by myself and by the wonderful people who share their experience and opinion on the platform. So I need to ask a few things from you, my dedicated listeners, to help get us to the point where we can take on some sponsors and help keep this podcast progressing and releasing new episodes every week. First, please share the podcast page or the Facebook page on your social media. Recommendations are how most people discover new media, so tell your friends and bandmates about the podcast. Secondly, please make sure you've subscribed to the podcast on whatever platform you use, and please go ahead and leave a rating if you use iTunes or something like that. 5 stars. If you haven't picked up a copy of the Musicians Map ebook or audiobook, go ahead and do that, and get in touch with your stories and suggestions. You can email me anytime at kane@musiciansmap.org or contact me through the Facebook group or the Facebook page. So that's done, and now we can get on with this week's episode, which I'm really excited about as it features Joe Branton from Brighton progressive band Polymath. Polymath have just released their new double album, House of Wisdom, We Are the Devil, and it's an absolute masterpiece. Full disclosure, I'm a big fan, and Joe was super generous in his interview. He talks about early influences, concept albums, art, crowdfunding, and music videos. We also discuss record labels, endorsements, and early plans for the next Polymath album.
If we're really, really honest and really basic about it, it all started from At The Drive-In. At The Drive-In were a massive catalyst for music in our area. Loads of us were listening to punk rock before then, and At The Drive-In really moved us into, oh, shit, you mean you can play weird notes and still be in a band and that'd be cool? So it was, they were a huge influence, and I think that sort of move into post-punk started a big transition specifically in Brighton and with a lot of bands that were happening at that time. So that was sort of our early thing. I mean, for us, for the Polymath guys, we've always been in separate bands to each other. There was always quite a tight community in Brighton, and there's always been like a group of maybe 5, maybe 10 bands all doing different things, and we were all listening to, I guess we were all really Radiohead influenced initially. It was that sort of thing that started us all off, but that, I mean, that's like pre-Polymath. We're all friends initially, the guys, but yeah, at yeah. The Drive-In, biggest influence.
They were so influential, weren't they, at The Drive-In, man? They did, as you said, they kind of changed the game and just opened it up for everybody. Yeah. Crazy band. So what about when you started playing bass guitar?
Where I grew up, there was a big punk rock scene. And so I started playing bass, as a lot of bass players do, I think, because everyone else we knew were guitarists. So yeah, so I started playing in a punk band around that same time. Tim, the guitarist in Polymath, he was a drummer first. So he was playing drums in a band called The Landing. And then Chris, the drummer in Polymath, he kind of fell into like a really popular scene. I think he shared the same influences that me and Tim had in music. He got more involved in actually trying to make a career out of music rather than trying to be in an instrumental prog band. So he was in a really successful band sort of early on. He was First of all, he was in a band called Steal Back Your Life, who were one of the most important post-punk bands on the Brighton scene. And then he joined an essentially a pop band called Doll on the Kicks, who were very successful. They went to support Morrissey like worldwide, wow. Sell like thousands and thousands of records. Like, you know, I guess he was pretty successful until he met me and Tim. So, yeah.
Why did you start Polymath and when did that happen?
Polymath was actually a side project. So I think at the time, both me and Crispy were playing in other bands, and Tim was playing drums in a very successful, well, as successful as post-rock can be, I guess, post-rock band called Monsters Build Mean Robots, with the frontman of that band was now the frontman of the band Alma, who are now doing really well. Mm. They were in a band together, and he was playing drums for that. And essentially, he wanted to play guitar again because he had in previous bands. And me and Chris were his friends who also loved the Mars Volta. So he sort of turned to us to do a side project. To be honest, the band only actually became to be anything because we were just messing around. And then a slot became available at the first year of Arctangent in Bristol, which I'm sure, as we'll go on to discuss, is the most important festival in the UK for avant-garde music. And because the promoter of that festival knew Tim quite well, and it was the first year for Arctangent, it was much smaller then, he was like, oh, I've heard that you've set up another band. Would you like to play an opening slot? And so we played that really before we were even a band. We'd been playing together 6 months. We'd done one gig before the festival set. We had no music released. We didn't really know what we were doing. We barely strung together a set. And we thought, well, this is great. It's a free ticket to a festival.
Yeah.
You know, so we weren't expecting anyone to show up to our show, but the stage we'd been put on was right next to the camping area. And as we started, people just started to come in their droves, and very, very luckily, and it's one of those stories that you can't tell without sounding like you're blowing your own trumpet, but very, very luckily, the tent filled up massively for a band that no one had ever heard, and everyone was very lovely and very excited about it. And so we sort of finished the set and were like, oh man, oh, people actually like this. Maybe we should start taking this more seriously. So I guess,
yeah,
I guess that was
the start, man. That's a cool story actually. And Arctangent is such a good festival, and it's so like that. I've been that camper before, listening to the first band, and sort of you wake up to it, or you know, you get up and you hear it and you go, oh, and just sort of stumble over, and then you found maybe a new favorite band, and the first band of the day, as you say. So something that struck me about Polymath when I first heard about you guys was the name. It kind of strikes you as quite a big statement, right?
Yeah.
Did you set this, is it like a goal, you know, that you've set yourself on purpose or something you need to live up to, or is it just become something that is just normal now?
Tim's actually put it best previously when asked about this, and he said it's an aspiration, it's not a statement.
Yep.
And that is the thing. Like, I think it can come across as quite heavily arrogant, I guess, to call a band that. But I mean, genuinely, we really named it on the basis of we quite liked the name more than it was anything we actually thought of ourselves. You know, all of us are multi-instrumental, but like, that doesn't qualify us as polymaths at all. So yeah, I think it's safe to say that this is an aspiration. But do you know what, like, I actually think, yeah, being sort of bold is a part of that. I think my biggest criticism of other math bands, I don't consider us a math band, but other bands that are our mates that we play with on the math circuit, and we're quite open about this, but my major criticism is no one takes themselves seriously enough. Not in an arrogant way, but everyone has funny names and funny song titles,
sure.
And I think it downplays how much effort and how much love people put into making the music in the first place. So
totally, man. I mean, Giraffes are the first band that spring to mind like that. Try and tell people, well, listen to Giraffes, and they're like, what? Yeah,
exactly. Fantastic band. I love Giraffes. So one of my favorite bands are, and really good friends of ours, are Alpha Male Tea Party.
Yep.
Already a ridiculous name. And like one of their biggest songs, you know, being, you listen to Genesis, of course you eat hummus. Or maybe it's the other way around. You know, it's like.
Yeah.
And yeah. it's just like, man, it's a great song. It's got some wonderful time signature changes and some fantastic sort of mood switches within the song. Like, I love everything about the track. And the title was funny. Like, you laughed. It's hilarious. Like, it's a great title. But I was like, man, if you had named that something serious, maybe people would consider it a bit more seriously. And that's totally cool. Like, we're very open to the fact that we don't take ourselves too seriously. But, man, I take writing music seriously. And so I like to sort of title it as such.
Absolutely. And I think we're definitely going to go over that, about the, you know, conceptual aspects of Polymath. But I want to kind of, while we're still early on, a lot of people listening maybe won't be that familiar with math or even strictly instrumental music. Most musical styles have vocals to provide a focal point and sort of give an obvious meaning, right?
Sure.
Maybe you could help some of the listeners understand, like, some of the techniques that you use to portray those things without using vocals in your music.
That's actually one of the trickiest things that we have to do, because we have to set like a motif or kind of, there has to be a root concept and then there has to be a mood before you start writing. Like, if you want to make music that doesn't have vocals, and vocals are very easy. Like, if you want to write a love song, then you have a chorus in that song that says how much you love that person. You know, it's very easy to set the conceptual basis of that song. So with instrumental music, and this is exactly what I'm talking about, you know, Giraffe Giraffe, Alpha Male, Tea Party, they're absolutely fantastic. But how do you set a mood? And the answer is that they don't necessarily. But then that's not part of their criteria, and that's not a problem. I think they're fantastic bands. It's more that we wanted to have concepts, we wanted to have moods, movements, ideas behind everything. And so in order to kind of portray that, it's very difficult, because it's difficult to do that without it being so unbelievably pretentious. And I think it's hard to sort of be like, no, look, we genuinely, like, we're trying to portray this one thing without it sounding like we're just we're just being tosses. But it's I guess what we do beforehand is we come up with a root concept. So we don't ever write track by track. Everything's written. We've always been concept. So, you know, our first record was written around Escher and Escher's artwork. So we selected a number of pieces and we sat down and talked about what we thought the meaning, function, mood and concept was behind those pieces. And then we were like, right, let's write some music that we feel summarizes that. That was the first record. We did it in the second record in Melancholia. We did that around the concept behind that piece of artwork. And then for this one, we decided to move away from artists and move towards history. And so for us, we were like, well, this is much easier to do, because for this, we can look at a historical event and we can look at the moods, the motifs, the concepts and the emotions that would have been associated with this particular piece of history and write around that. So it's always, tracks are always written around a broad idea rather than sort of a, you know, track by track basis.
Sure. And it's interesting that visual aspect of art is informing directly the musical choices that you're making.
Yeah.
With the new record, the artwork associated with that is, so you said, you know, it's historical, as historical events are informing the music choices.
Yeah.
Was the visual art created before the music, or was it created after the music?
Oh, that's actually an interesting question with this one, because we always use the same artist. So the artist we use is this fella, Sam Hall, who's done everything for us ever. He's a great mate and a fantastic artist. We met him in a really funny way in Brighton. They do these really strange events called open houses, where people literally open their homes to art installations. And you know nothing more about them than there are signs on the street saying this is an open house and you can pop in and see them. And we learn about Sam from, here's the problem with open houses, anything can be in them. So we learn about this artist from a friend of ours who was like, I have a friend who's doing this art installation. He does all this ink and paper, muscle and sinew artwork, and he's over at this open house. And I was like, muscle and sinew ink and paper artwork, that sounds really interesting. I looked the fella up and I was like, man, this artwork looks great. And we contacted him off the back of that and have used him for everything since. And he's now like a really good friend of ours. That was a very long-winded way of answering this question. for this particular record, it was slightly different because we were looking into the concept of doing the House of Wisdom record, and we were looking into the story of the fall of Baghdad, the Mongolian invasion in 1258. That was something that we were really researching. I went onto Sam's website, and he had temporarily shut it down, and he put this massive, weird image on the front of his website. And I was like, man, that looks incredible. And I right-clicked on it, and it allowed me to download the image. And the image downloaded as the title of the image that he'd uploaded as his holding page was We Are the Devil. And that image ended up being one of the optional cover pieces to our record, because it is a, you can fold the record sleeve either way, so you can have one of two covers. But that ended up being one of the covers that we could have. And I called Sam like that day, and I was like, this artwork's incredible. Would you mind if we use this as partial inspiration and also nicked your title?
Yeah. So that's why it's dual titled. Yeah.
Exactly. If anything, Sam this time round is completely responsible for us having a dual titled album. But normally the artwork is based on, we give Sam a set of information and we say, yeah, this is the sort of thing we want, create something from that. This time he created half of it beforehand, but it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, this time the front covers have loads of tiny little references. On one side, on the House of Wisdom side, loads of references to science and technological advancements. And on the reverse side, on the We Are the Devil side, loads of references to the destruction that is, and modern destruction as well. So there are references to the way we're tampering with things today as well. It's not just based on, we kind of view this, the Mongolian invasion in 1258, the destruction of the Houses of Wisdom, that step back, that move out of the Islamic Golden Age, as being very much like a comment on the way society inevitably suffers from the influence of sort of blind right-wing-ism,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, sure. So who's coming up with the ideas for the concepts? Who's saying, hey, guys, you know, the Mongolian invasion of Baghdad, I learned about it, I read it, I'm interested in it, here's what it is about. Do you think we should pursue that, or should we pursue the something different? What's the process there?
Well, it is very much between the three of us. We will discuss it and all agree on a topic. It's normally me that brings the topics to the band, and normally we'll discuss two or three things. I think in this case, on this record, I was very much like, I've never read anything like this, and I can't believe this isn't a story that is told the world over. I can't believe I've never seen a film on this. Like, it's such a fantastic and it's such an amazing story. And it's such a shame that it's never been brought to film, or it's not taught in schools. Like, it's such an incredible story. It's such a massive step back in time for an entire culture, for it to be something that, man, I read about briefly on Wikipedia and then had to order a book on. And I could find like a couple of books on it. I just think that's mad. Considering all the absolute bullshit stories that we get taught in school, I thought this was a phenomenal piece of history that really should be focused on a lot more. And so I think this time round, I was very much like, this is what we are doing a record on. And, you know, in fairness to Tim and Chris, they were very much like, when I told them about it, explained it to them, they were like, yeah, this is absolutely what we're doing this record on. So,
yeah, I was introduced to you guys when Melancholia was released. Something that struck me was that it had three songs for the track listing, and it was an album of about half an hour long. Most people would sort of separate the songs into sections. You know, it's a natural tendency to go, right, you know, we're about 4 or 5 minutes up, let's kind of end it. This other idea can be the start of a new track. But you guys didn't. You just kept it flowing. And it kind of flows from start to finish anyway, but you've separated it into three tracks rather than what could be five, maybe.
Yeah.
So is that just a writing device and you just don't cut it? What's the story there?
Well, I think so. I mean, essentially, we tend to write those songs as individual pieces. And I guess we're not happy with a track until it's kind of completed its journey. And I think sometimes whilst there's three tracks across 30 minutes, those 10-minute tracks, I mean, if you were to cut them short, I kind of feel like they would have gone nowhere. We felt like we've done that a bit on previous records, like cut things short in order to bulk up track listings, to be honest, to make it look like we have more tracks on a record, because we know that, you know, bands write 3-minute tracks and think that that's fine. And we've always written 10-minute tracks. It was just, we were like, maybe we should split these up in order to make people think there's more content here. Because I think people look at track listings rather than song lengths. 30 minutes is as long as, I mean, Brighton's a big punk rock town. That EP is probably longer than most of my friends' bands' records that they've ever put out.
Yeah,
it is, which is fine. I love punk rock, but it's I think for us, we always feel like a track has to have its complete movement, and that tends to be 4 or 5 sections that will progress, and then we'll have one reoccurring motif throughout. But we always want to do that, and we often crescendo, and a crescendo is always worth like 3 or 4 minutes, and we don't ever want to do that without the rest of the song. Do you know what, like recently we were played on Radio 1, which over here is it's the biggest station in the UK. I didn't mention that as it being like, hey, we got played.
Sure.
Maybe I did. But we got played on that radio station, and they contacted us and were like, hey, we want to play your single, but you know, like your single is 9 minutes long. Can you give us a radio edit? And so we busted our balls talking to our producer in Ireland and being like, is there any way you can cut down this song? Like, can you think of any way to do that? We can't. And he was like, yeah, I'm sure I can. He ended up sending us like a 5-minute radio edit, and we sent that to Radio 1. They played the last 2 minutes of that track. So they didn't play the radio, which is totally fine. I appreciate like that their listeners wouldn't be into this anyway. It was a big stretch for them to do that. But they played the last 2 minutes, and it was like the last 2 minutes were a crescendo. The last 2 minutes were the same riff repeated, getting louder and louder. And I was like, man, if that was the first time I'd heard us, I wouldn't be into us, because that sounded terrible. Like, you know, a band that make a 2.5-minute song with one riff
just
to
crescendo
louder and louder. Yeah, exactly. It was rubbish. It sounded rubbish. But I think that's why our songs are so long, because maybe we consider the motifs for ludicrously long amounts of time.
Was there a kind of freedom with the new record, with House of Wisdom, We Are the Devil? It's epic, man. I listened to it yesterday, and it's like it's a long listen, and it's incredible. But it must have been satisfying for you guys to just go, you know what, let's just write lots of music, make it really long, and have it this big kind of, because essentially it's a double record, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a double album, because it's long enough to be essentially. Yep. It's 74 minutes or whatever it is. But I think, do you know what, we were a bit bored of being called a math band. We're referred to as a math band because we play with math bands, because we've turned up at a similar time to math music. But we were like, man, we listen to Yes and King Crimson and the Mars Volta. Like, none of those bands are math. Like, and we don't like math bands. Math bands tap, and finger tapping on a guitar is vulgar. We don't do that. So it was kind of like, man, we have nothing in common with these bands. It's just that we play in weird time signatures, and people seem to think that that makes us math. So we got sort of lumped in this genre, which was fantastic, because we've made loads of wonderful friends, and we're all quite open about the fact that we don't think of ourselves as a math band. We're old. We're way older than any of the other bands in our genre.
Sure.
We are big, big prog fans.
And you guys crowdfunded.
We did.
How did that go? And would you do it again?
The crowdfunding was actually excellent. It was really wonderful, because essentially we've released records before, and we went back to the same record labels that we've released on before, and we're like, hey, we want to do a double album. And of course, that's massively expensive for a band that make instrumental weird prog music. You know, three guys approaching their 40s, like, making instrumental prog music is not exactly the most lucrative of concepts for a record label. So a lot of the labels we approached were a bit concerned about that. So we became aware that if we were going to do this, we'd need help from people if they wanted to hear us make such a record. So we're very lucky to get people to assist us and put that out. So we were super chuffed with that. We couldn't be happier with how supportive our fans have been. We did a few cool things, like we wanted there to be some spoken word on this record. And we thought, rather than recording it ourselves, we put it out there to people. So we said, look, you know, if you want to support the record, you can send us in sound submissions. And I gave them information on the sort of sound submissions I wanted, and loads of people sent them in, and they make up like a good portion of the album are just our fans sending in sort of recordings. And that's the best awesome. Part is, like, the quality didn't really matter because I was always going to manipulate them anyway. So I had great fun sort of messing around with them. And I got people to send in stuff. We got people where I was like, I sent everyone who said they wanted to be a part of it, I sent them specific sound recordings saying, I want you to say these lines in this pentameter. And I would speak it. And I was like, I want you to record this along with this recording so that we have the same pentameter so that I could double up people's focus with it, which was great. I did other things where I was like, I want you to be creative here. I really need some whispering. Go nuts. Like, you can say nothing words. You can do whatever you want. We had people submit whispering the instructions for making tea off of the back of a tea packet, which is on the record. We reversed it and shoved it through a real tape Roland Space Echo.
Yep.
That I had to rent in, like a proper old sort of 70s Space Echo, and we had someone's tea instructions running reverse through that, which was great. It makes a great section of the record. Mm. And yeah, it was wonderful having people involved. I wouldn't change that at all.
It almost serves a dual purpose, because it's helping fund the album, but it's encouraging fan engagement, right? And it's almost promoting the record as well, because there's all these updates, and if you follow on social, you're getting all these updates from the crowdfunding campaign. Something that I really liked that you guys did for both Melancholia and for the new record was your live in studio videos.
Oh yeah.
how did you make those? Was it just for marketing purposes, or was it just for music videos? What was the...
Do you mean like the making of videos that we did?
There were some making of videos, but there were a couple of like live performance videos.
Which
I thought specifically were really cool.
Oh right, yeah. So we arranged those sort of slightly separately, but in the same sessions. So just because we had some friends who could film some stuff, so we recorded some completely live versions of the songs as we were recording them, which was great. And those were really fun. And yes, I guess those were for marketing purposes, just to show people what we were doing. Mm. We really enjoyed recording stuff just in the studio as well. I kind of hope people like those as well, because we record best like really, really drunk. So that's the best time for us to film stuff as well. So it's I hope that those videos sort of come across as fun as we think they were.
Yeah.
But we love making those little live videos. I tell you what, just in general, we have always found that we're an instrumental band. We don't want to make music videos. Like, we don't want to do mime stuff as much as we can avoid. I'm not interested in putting like storylines and plots and things like that in our music videos. I'll leave that to people who make films. And, you know, we actually write scores on the side for a few friends of ours who do make films. But I wouldn't presuppose to use those for our music videos. I don't, and have never thought that that's the place for music. If you want to listen to our tracks, then surely you want to see us perform them.
Yeah.
So all our videos have always been live performances rather than abstract concepts that are written by someone else who has nothing to do with the band.
Yeah.
And then the music just serves to be background music to someone else's concept sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, I can understand that totally. So House of Wisdom came out on two record labels, correct?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So it's Lonely Voyage and Superstar Destroyer.
Lonely Voyage and Nice Weather for Airstrikes. Superstar Destroyer released Melancholia. Lonely Voyage released Reptiles. And then Lonely Voyage have come back to release this one. And we have also had Nice Weather for Airstrikes release this record as well. So it's been a dual release. The reason being, we wanted to release a double album, and releasing that on vinyl is very expensive. So, So we were lucky enough that two labels were willing to support us. So,
what sort of arrangement do you have with those labels and labels like that at an independent level?
A very, very intimate one. In the Lonely Voyage, who put out our first record, who the fellas who run that, Joe, Josh, and Adam are three of the most fantastic and most involved guys in this genre I've ever met. Adam, especially, the guy who heads it up, he's the guitarist in a band called Lost in the Riots, a sort of an instrumental, like, party math band, who are absolutely fantastic. He's one of the most fun and brilliant guitarists I've ever seen on a stage. We were lucky enough to tour with them just before they actually agreed to release our album about 3 or 4 years ago. He's completely fantastic, a wonderful musician. So it was an honor to get to put anything out on their label. And then, yeah, Lonely Voyage, which is run, and you'll start to see the connections here, run by Pete Lambrew, who is the guitarist and singer in Alma. He was also the guitarist and singer in Monsters Build Me Robots, which Tim, our guitarist, was the drummer in. So there's the connection there. That's why Lonely Voyage agreed to put it out. They were always kind of our fail-safe because we've always been really good friends. In fact, all of us put together used to, before Arctangent, before any of those festivals existed, when math was a tiny, tiny genre, we used to put on a festival called Nice Weather for Airstrikes Festival, probably about 7 or 8 years ago. We used to put it on in a tiny pub in Brighton, and it was fantastic, a load of fun. I mean, one year we managed to get Three Trap Tigers to play there. Three Trap Tigers and Maybe She Will played there as well.
Awesome.
And Shapes. And I remember this pub could maybe fit 50 people was safe, 80 people was tops. And I think we counted at 250 people queued to wow. try and get in to yeah. see. And that was actually before we were in Polymath and everything. That was when we were just friends who loved the genre and wanted to put on bands. And before Arctangent was a thing, but people still wanted it to be a thing. And yeah. That is our connection with Nice Weather for Airstrikes. And cool. And actually, I guess the other side of that is from Lonely Voyage, one of the three guys who runs that, Josh, has just become the fourth member of Polymath. We have recently taken on an organ player, and we played with him for the last 4 or 5 shows, just for our last tour.
Cool.
So we have switched from a 3 to a 4-piece and taken on
awesome.
our first new member.
If you wouldn't mind, I want to talk a little bit about endorsements. You're endorsed by Stonefield and TC Electronics, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That is. We were also endorsed by Boss FX as well.
How does that happen? How do you get those endorsements and what kind of deals do they have?
Okay, so Stonefield are, I guess a few years ago, I saw them at the London Bass Guitar Show, and they were some of the most ridiculous basses I'd ever seen. And of course, the Stonefield bass is about, well, they're a New Zealand local company, but they're about, you know, $4,500 New Zealand dollars for a bass. So they're pretty pricey. And I saw them there and was like, no, this is incredible. I will never be able to buy one of these. And I think about a year later, they were trying to get into the UK. I knew some of the people who were distributing their brand in the UK. And Boss, they were just about to release this new multi-effects unit, and they had sent me and Tim the prototype of this unit, and they were like, hey, we want you to do a video for this pedal, we want you to spend a few weeks make some weird sounds with this pedal, work out a song, and we want to record a live version of that song as the advert for this pedal. So we were like, well, okay, we'll do that. And so because I knew the fella who was going to be the brand that we're going to be distributing Stonefield, I gave them a shout and said, hey, look, I'm going to be doing this video for Boss. Obviously, it's Boss. They're the biggest effects company, you know, in the world. If you've got a spare Stonefield bass and you want me to play it in this video, I know they're a really small company and I really love their basses. So if you want me to play one in this video, I'll play it, and that will be great exposure for the brand. I did that, and then Tom Stanley, the guy who owns Stonefield, contacted me after and was like, I'd like you to play Stonefield basses, and I'd like to give you a custom version of a Stonefield bass to your spec so that you can play that. So that was absolutely wonderful and not something I expected at all. Now, it was really good because actually the way it's worked with Stonefield has worked very well for me, because two very close friends of mine are Freak Bass and another guy called JD Short, two fantastic bass players. And all three of us have ended up being the only three endorsees for Stonefield. Freak Bass slightly before me and JD Short slightly after me. And which is great because, you know, like Tom was arranging, there was a big in-store event in Cincinnati a few weeks ago. I couldn't actually go to it, but he was having all his endorsees over and had invited me and offered to pay for a flight for me to go over. And that would have been, you know, essentially me and two of my best mates would have got to go and show off these bases in a shop, which would have been great. But I mean, the two of them got to go. But yeah, very randomly and luckily, the three of us have ended up all with Stonefield bases, which is great.
Yeah. What's the future look like for Polymath, for your band, but for a band of your kind of genre as well?
The plan with the last record is, this is a very honest version of what we plan to make. We were trying to make the most ridiculous record we possibly could. And if we're really honest, we did talk about this. We were like, will someone give us a 1 out of 10? Because if you get a 1 out of 10, then someone didn't get something so much that they couldn't understand it at all. And if you can do that, then you surely have created the most outlandish record of all.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the, unfortunately that hasn't worked at all. We've actually had great reviews, but we've realized we've got to push this a bit further. So we've already actually planned the next record. And I'll give you an insight onto it here. The next record, actually, rather than it being a full album, we're releasing a single song. It's going to be one 30-minute song. And it's our first 3D recording. So we're making a binaural record. So whilst it's a half-hour song, there are movements within that song, but rather than giving you a track listing, what we're giving people is a blueprint, a top-down view of a building, and then a path around that building with rough times as to where you're in what path in the building. And the song will switch binaurally depending on what time it is and where you are. So as you walk through doors, tracks can dissipate the same way that they would as a club door shuts behind you. Tracks can get quieter as you ascend up or down staircases along with footsteps. And also as this is a first person thing, it's a binaural recording, the character that you are as you're listening to the record will interact with people and have conversations as they're moving through this building. But I guess the idea is to create like a complete first person binaural record as such. So that's the next thing. We've already started working on that and laying down the foundations for that. So we're just getting the finer points of that in place now.
How do you even approach that?
Well, actually, our producer, Lee McMahon, who produced And So Watch You From Afar, amongst a ton of other sort of less outlandish bands, he said to us years ago, maybe when we recorded Melancholia, he was like, man, I really want to do a 3D recording. And we were like, yeah, so did we. And so we've actually been working on it since then, coming up with how we would go about that. And we tested that on this record, actually. Our track Geography is recorded live. Chris, our drummer, is playing the piano part, and we literally walked past the room with a microphone, and the audio you hear is the sound of that piano echoing into the hallway, passing the room where it becomes louder, and then walking down towards the control room where the door then shuts, and that's where the sound dissipates. And that essentially is going to be the gist behind this. We're going to have to splice live recordings with slightly more professional recordings as we're moving a binaural head around a room. Which sounds very, very pretentious, but I'm...
Dude, I mean, man, if you can pull
that
off.
It was a great idea at the time.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. It really does.
And that's all for this week. Thank you so much to Joe Branton. Check out Polymath and their new album, House of Wisdom, We Are the Devil, at facebook.com/polymathbrighton and wearepolymath.bandcamp.com. Joe has chosen two bands for Artist of the Week, Sewer and Alma. and both have difficult spellings, so I'm not going to read the links out. You'll find links in the episode description to check out both bands. This podcast and the website musiciansmap.org is dedicated to sharing knowledge and advice about music and the music industry. It's all about community, honesty, and positive progress. The experiences, stories, and advice shared on the podcast are given freely with the hope that you can relate to them and benefit from them. If you've found this podcast enjoyable or useful, make sure to check out the Musicians Map ebook and audiobook about building success in music. You'll find it at musiciansmap.org/books, Amazon, and Audible. And buying a copy of the book directly contributes to the continuation of this podcast. There's also a free ebook, How to Get Your Music Heard. Go to musiciansmap.org/free-book to get your copy. If you have a suggestion for the podcast or for the YouTube channel, or you just want to get in touch and say hello, please do so via the Musicians Map Facebook group or by email at kane@musiciansmap.org. Thanks for listening and stay positive.